Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket in the order of their presentation they are. Allstate Insurance Company versus Rhonda Bonner from Travis County. In the interest of A.D., a child from Jefferson County. An American Motorist Insurance Company and Tom Gibson versus Barbara Ann Fodge from Dallas County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present arguments. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. We will take a recess in between each argument and we'll complete the arguments before lunch. The clerk of the court is taping these arguments and you may purchase a tape from the clerk's office of any argument for a nominal fee. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Allstate versus Bonner.
May it please the court, Mr. Wade Crosnay will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I first want to briefly summarize what Allstate's position is on the Article 2155 issues before the court. Allstate's position is first that the plain language of Article 2155 requires that the insured present a valid insurance claim, that is, a claim that must be paid by the insurer as a prerequisite to liability under Article 2155. It is further our position that Ms. Bonner's claim for uninsured motorist benefits was not valid, and that is because Allstate made a pre-suit payment of $1,619 in PIP benefits to Ms. Bonner before she ever filed suit. Our policy had a non-duplication of benefits provision, which stated that we were not required to pay any damages under the UM coverage that we had already paid under the PIP coverage. Ms. Bonner, in fact, stipulated that that provision implied to the entire PIP payment, and this court has recently upheld in the Kidd case the validity of that provision.
Is that provision in every Texas automobile insurance policy?
Yes, Your Honor, the standard personal auto policy. In this case, the jury found that Ms. Bonner suffered $1,000 in damages as a result of the uninsured motorist negligence. So this was effectively showing that Allstate had overpaid the claim in the amount of $619. Nonetheless, we're not here asking for a refund. We're simply here saying that the Court of Appeals misconstrued the statute to permit Ms. Bonner to recover attorney's fees incurred in pursuing a meritless claim. Now I want to turn to each of these issues in a little bit more detail. First, again, to our position that Article 2155 requires a valid insurance claim. This interpretation is supported by the plain language of the statute. Section 1, subpart 3 of the statute defines a claim as a first-party claim that must be paid by the insurer. Furthermore, Section 6 of the statute...
I'm a little bit confused by your heavy reliance on Section 1, Part 3, the definitional section of claim. You keep divorcing the language directly to the insured or beneficiary from the that must be paid by the insurer. And I know you are interpreting that to mean that the must be paid language means it has to be a claim that must be paid. In other words, a claim on which money is owed that is valid.
Right.
But it's the definitional section of the statute, and if I apply that particular definition to each place in the statute where the word claim is used, it doesn't work.
Oh, where are you thinking?
Well, I'm looking at the various places where there are rejection of claims, for example. If the insurer in subpart section 3, the repeated references to if the insurer rejects the claim. How can it reject a claim that must be paid if, in fact, that's the way the definition works?
There is that use in Section 3, but given the plain definition, we don't believe that use overrides the definition given in Section 1.
But my point is that it seems to me you've divorced you've lifted some of the words from the definition to give it a meaning that is different than what the complete definition means. The definition talks about basically defining a first-party claim, a claim that must be paid directly. You keep divorcing the directly, and you turn the that must be paid into valid, but when I try to apply that definition, not only to Section 3, but other places in the statute where there is reference to claims that an insurer decides not to pay, then I have an inconsistency.
And I'm
can you square that for me, or am I misunderstanding your argument?
I'm not trying to divorce the language from the directly payable to the insured. Again, on that, I think if the legislature had intended something different, they would have said something like that would be payable to the insured directly
My point is that if I read the definition together and I define and I say then a claim means a first party claim as opposed to the fact that a claim means a valid claim, then the definition works every place I see the word claim used in Article 21.55. However, if I read it the way you want me to read it and just use the language must be paid, then the definition doesn't work in numerous places in the statute.
Well, if you go to Section 6 of the statute, and given your example there, your example wouldn't work there because if you said...
Do you agree with me that if I apply that definition in other places in the statute the way you would read Section 3, that it doesn't work?
It doesn't work in that particular section of Section 3, which is a different statute, a different section than the part about acknowledgement of claims.
And in fact, a definitional provision of the statute is intended then to apply to every place that term is used in the statute.
Yes.
And it doesn't work by the way you would interpret that subpart.
It doesn't work in that particular section.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Thank you.
But let me clarify under Section, if you go to Section 6, though, Section 6 that authorizes recovery of the statutory penalty of 18% and attorney's fees on a claim only when the insurer is liable therefore, and you can't be liable therefore if it's not a valid claim.
Going back again, though, to your definition of claim, the first of sections, and we can talk about the libel, therefore, because I know that's another one of your plain language arguments, but again, in all cases where a claim is made, I mean, it's talking about if you apply the definition to mean a first-party claim, then where a first-party claim is made and nothing more is required. But if you start adding on the valid claim part, then it seems again to distort the meaning.
Well,
so I'm having a hard time with your first plain language argument. I wanted to give you a chance to try to explain it to me.
It may be, although, that the legislature was using claim in the generic sense at some point in the statute, but I don't think so in Section 6, because if you read that Section 6 to permit an 18% penalty on the amount of the claim and read that to mean not the amount that's owed under the policy, but read it to mean the amount that's demanded by the insured to be paid, well, in that situation, it's, let's say the insured comes in and says, I want $1 million on my UM claim, and it's ultimately determined that $5,000 is owed, for instance. Well, under that reading of the statute, you would owe 18% on the $1 million.
But I don't have to interpret the definitional term that way in order to give that particular read to Section 6.
In order to give it a reading?
Yes, the reading that you're saying, I don't have to use the definitional section in the way you would have us read it.
And why is that? That's what I don't...
Well, I mean, you're hanging your hat on some other language in Section 6, I thought.
Right, well, I'm just saying, if you read Section 6 to reference claim to mean something other than the claim that must be paid and to mean the claim that's demanded, then it doesn't make any sense because you end up paying a statutory penalty on the amount that's demanded rather than the amount that's owed.
So there's not any other language in Section 6 that you hang your hat on besides
we
claim?
Are hanging our hat on additional language, the libel therefore language. We are hanging our hats as well on the in addition to the amount of the claim language, where the legislature has said that if you prove a violation of the statute, the insured recovers in addition to the amount of the claim, the statutory penalty and the attorney's fees. And that's somewhat similar to the legislature's language in Section 38.001, the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, where the legislature said if you prevail on a cause of action, you get attorney's fees in addition to the amount of the valid claim. And we think that should all be interpreted consistently.
But the word valid is included in Section 38.001.
Well, and again, our position is, given the definition, that it must be a claim. When you look at every section of the statute, it says a claim that must be paid by the insurer, the libel therefore language, the in addition to.
Let me ask you about the libel therefore language. The court's holding in Kidd is that you don't stack PIP and uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. And in fact, there's an offset that's available. Is that correct? Is that your understanding of Kidd?
Well, the court specifically used the term non-duplication of benefits rather than offset, because I believe there is a distinction.
That's the language that's in the policy.
The policy doesn't say offset or non-duplication.
No. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The policy does not say non-duplication of benefits or offset. What it says is in order to avoid basically double recoveries. I'm struggling for the language, but it doesn't say duplication of benefits, but
But it doesn't mean that someone does not have a valid claim under either of the coverages, or that in fact the claim is covered. It just means you can't recover the benefits twice. Isn't that what the opinion says?
No.
Because in that particular case, like in this case, she did try her uninsured motorist claim to a jury and got jury findings on it. It's just that she wasn't entitled to recover because she'd already recovered the amount of benefits.
Yes, she was not entitled to recover benefits under the policy.
But it was a covered claim.
I don't agree that it was a covered claim. We had no obligation to pay the claim because we'd already paid it.
Well, but how could you ever get to the point where you'd answer a non-duplication of benefits question if there wasn't ever any right to benefits under two different provisions of the policy?
Well, the right to the PIP benefits are not at issue here because we paid them, and we paid them before the suit.
I understand, but I'm just trying to interpret KID in terms of its overlay with looking at this particular statute. And it's my question to you is, do you interpret KID to mean that if a person has already recovered PIP benefits, that it's not just a question of not receiving benefits twice, but it actually means that the uninsured motorist claim is then not covered by the terms of the policy?
The claim is it falls within the coverage, but then there's a limitation to coverage.
Right.
That
okay.
Applies.
So it's a covered claim under the policy. But then whether or not and how much the benefits have to be paid under that coverage depend on how much has been paid under another provision of the policy.
Right. But it is a limitation on coverage that in effect means that you didn't owe the benefits. You didn't breach your contract by not paying them, and I think that's the key point.
Okay. Thank you.
Also want to we talked a little bit about the statutory language, and I also want to talk a little bit about the case law under Article 2155. There is the Rodriguez case out of San Antonio that states very clearly that you have to have a valid claim in order to get liability under Article 2155. We do think it's important that this court has similarly interpreted other fee-shifting statutes in the Beeston case. It's interpreted Section 38.001, Article 2121 of the Insurance Code, and the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to require a showing that the insured prevailed on the cause of action for which fees were recoverable and recovered damages.
But now, can you tell me, who is the prevailing party in this litigation? Who would have been the prevailing party below under our jurisprudence regarding taxing of costs and prevailing party?
This court, specifically to whether or not you're a successful party.
No, prevailing party, that's a jurisprudential term that we've used in terms of awarding costs.
Okay. And I was just referring to what Rule 131 says. But in terms of awarding costs, take a look, for instance, at the Grayson case, which is out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals. That's a case where the court said that a plaintiff who filed an underinsured motorist claim and submitted it, case was presented to the jury. Jury found that she suffered damages as a result of the underinsured motorist negligence, Those damages were $6,500, but she had stipulated before trial that she was entitled to a $20,000, or that the insurer was entitled to a $20,000 settlement credit because she had settled with the underinsured motorist for that amount before trial. Well, the court said, even though if this were a negligence case, you would have prevailed in the sense that you got a finding of negligence and damages, this is a contractual case. And because it was a contract, you were also required to show, in addition to negligence by the uninsured motorist, in addition to damages, you were obligated to show you otherwise were entitled to recover under the policy. And you didn't do that because you didn't obtain, or you didn't show that the motorist was, in fact, underinsured. And therefore, you weren't able to recover under the policy. This court made it recognized a similar distinction between the contractual nature of a UM claim in the Henson case, where it said, you know, even though you obtain a finding that the uninsured motorist was negligent and that damaged you, that does not necessarily show that you can get prejudgment interest because it's a contract case rather than a tort case.
Well, and the reason that I ask that is under Section 6, the legislature seems to have put in there, if suit is filed, such attorney's fees shall be taxed as costs. And so can we look to that prevailing party jurisprudence to guide us in interpreting the statute?
I still think you have to have a valid claim in order to even get to a recovery of attorney's fees, but if you go to the prevailing party jurisprudence, I think we prevail on that based upon the Blizzard case and the Grayson case that are cited in our brief.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Okay, please, the court, Mr. Philip K. Maxwell and Mark Crafton, argument from respondent. Mr. Maxwell opens the first 15 minutes.
Mr. Crampton is here to respond to any questions the court might have concerning the procedural matter with regard to the record. My comments will be directed to 2155 of the Insurance Code. And picking up on Justice Hankinson's inquiry, the statute obviously uses claim in different meanings in the statute. The definition, it seems to me, is really to distinguish between first-party and third-party claims, that 2155, for example, could not be used by a third-party claimant against a liability insurer for the tortfeasor, but that when you get to the requirements of the statute, unlike 3.62, which was its predecessor statute that dealt only with life, health, and accident policies, the only duty under that statute was to pay within 30 days of the demand. And if you didn't pay within 30 days of the demand, you were liable for the 12% penalty. 2155 was a major departure from the prompt payment of claim statute, and it posed specific deadlines by which insurers are to do certain things, one of which is acknowledgement of the claim. And as one of the amicus pointed out, I believe it was the one filed by the Baker & Botts law firm, forgotten the client, I think it was Farmers, on whose behalf they filed it, recognized that many of the duties that are provided in 2155 apply to invalid claims because you don't know whether a claim is valid or invalid when it's submitted.
And well, so, even giving you that, can we go to insurer liable, therefore?
Well, I take that language to mean, in the context in which it's written, that you're liable for the claim under the terms of the policy. That is, that it goes back to the nature of the contractual arrangement. The insurer that is liable for the claim is the one under which the policy is obliged to make payment. They may have certain offset rights. But all this does is describe the proper party against which the suit is brought, and you get that from it. It says in all cases where a claim is made, well, a claim was made in this case. The insurer liable for that claim, of course, is Allstate under the specific provisions of the uninsured motorist sections of the policy of insurance. And then, and I think this is important, they are not in compliance with the requirements of this statute. That is, a statutory obligation to acknowledge a claim within 15 days of receipt.
But you left out the middle part. You left out the middle part, which says, and the insurer is liable therefore.
The insurer in this case is liable for this claim.
Under the policy, is the insurer liable?
Absolutely.
What does the policy provide?
You read the uninsured motorist coverage. They are liable to pay for any sums for which that are compensable as damages that are caused by an uninsured or underinsured motorist. In this case, there was $1,000 found by the jury that was under the uninsured motorist coverage.
What about the non-duplication of benefits provision?
Absolutely. It's an affirmative defense.
Right.
It's an exclusion or limitation.
And under the non-duplication of benefits provision, the insurer is not liable to pay any money for this claim.
You're asking for my construction of this term, and the only way it makes any sense if the statutory penalty provision is to be applied to ensure compliance with the statute, if it's limited only to claims for which there is no offset and therefore recovery on part of the plaintiff, then you've read out the penalty provision and the enforcement mechanism by which the statute is enforced.
Well, let's go back and cover some ground. First of all, do you agree that the insurer is not liable for this claim?
I do not agree that the insurer is not liable for the claim.
So you do not agree that the non-duplication of benefits provision does not exonerate the insurer from liability?
No, I do agree with that. I think there's a distinction
between
those two. So you do
agree that the insurer is not liable for this claim?
This is... If you want to read the statute, that
is the insurer liable to pay under the insurance policy?
Not if they take advantage of the offset provision. But what I'm saying to you, that you cannot read this statute, which provides one enforcement mechanism and one alone.
Let me ask you this. Then under your interpretation, you could have any situation in the world where an insurer is not liable. They don't have coverage at all that applies to a situation. And an insurer thinks, well, you know, golly gee, I might be able to pick up a few bucks in attorney's fees just by filing a claim, and maybe the insurer won't respond within 15 days. Whammo, even though there's no coverage, by golly, I have a claim. And I can collect $50,000 in attorney's fees. This is a great racket that could be created here.
Absolutely not. In this case, and in the cases to which this statute applies, There must be a policy of insurance, and the insurance company must be liable for payments under the policy.
But you've agreed.
There's no
already.
Question that they are liable for payments under the policy, but for the application of an affirmative defense or a limitation of liability based on non-duplication.
If she had not gotten favorable jury findings on the uninsured motorist negligence, so that there would not have been coverage.
Right.
And would you say that there was, could she recover attorney's fees under Section 6?
The affirmative findings, there must be a finding of a liability under the policy.
Well, and that's my question. If there was a finding that because the driver was not negligent, then she would not have been entitled to, but the claim was not covered.
Absolutely.
Would she be able to recover attorney's fees under Section 6?
That's a problem, I think, awaits a proper case. I
want to know the implications. Your opponent says, and I think it's a serious question, that what this would allow people to do is bring frivolous claims against insurance companies, as he said, for $1 million. No way in the world is it covered. We're not talking about duplication, non-duplication of benefits provisions at all. Just a bogus $1 million claim when the insurance company happens to miss a 15-day notice deadline, and therefore when they sue under Article 2155, they get to recover 18% off $1 million, $1 million and the attorney's fees. So I guess, you know, how far does it go in terms of when you say liable therefore?
Does it
require there to be coverage under the policy in order for Section 6 to be triggered? And then we can get into the semantics of non-duplication of benefits.
Well, I believe that in this case, the insurer is liable under the uninsured motorist coverage under the jury findings in this case. And so to hold that Ms. Bonner is entitled to her fees doesn't require the court to reach whether or not in a totally bogus million-dollar claim that is not covered by the policy, that that fees and penalties could be assessed.
Well, let's back
that stretches the statutory language. Yes.
Let's just get back to Justice O'Neill's question to your opposing counsel in Blizzard or any of these other cases. When the plaintiff makes gets a finding from a jury that's favorable, but after all offsets the amount of judgment, the amount paid is going to be zero, who pays the court costs?
Well, I think in that situation, I'm not sure. Thankfully, I've not been in that position, so I've not had the cost taxed against me in that sort of situation. But it seemed, the way I understand the jurisprudence of prevailing party under cost is the vindication of a legal right, and I think that is determined by the jury findings and not by the final judgment. I have to say that there are cases cited in our response. I did not write the response, so I do not know what those cases are. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but we can stand on our brief with regard to those authorities for that proposition. It's the vindication of a legal right. The vindication does not require the entry of judgment, but simply affirmative jury findings, if I understand it.
If I could follow up on my question, my understanding of your argument is that this is not a fee-shifting statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. If it's not
it obviously shifts fees.
Well, but under those cases that are dealing with fee-shifting statutes, my understanding is you're claiming this is more of a penalty.
It is a penalty.
Well, if it's not a fee-shifting statute, why did the legislature put that last sentence in there about awarding attorney's fees as costs?
Well, I mean, it's a penalty statute in the sense it provides for an 18% penalty. It has a fee-shifting component because it's trying to reduce or eliminate the transaction costs that stand between the injured plaintiff and enforcement of the statute.
So that in terms of, as far as the attorney's fee provision, then, you agree that it is a fee-shifting statute? It's only the 18% is the penalty?
Obviously, the assessment of fees in a case against a party is going to have a deterrent effect. So it certainly has the aspects of penal aspects to it, deterrent aspects to it. In a case where 18% of the claim may be $100, the fee may be $3,500, which is a bigger penalty, which is more, has more deterrent effect, the $3,500 or the $100. Obviously, the $3,500 does. So I think you have to look at it in toto. I don't know whether this inquiry.
You're talking about effect. I'm talking more about purpose. Now, my understanding of the briefing on the other side in this case is that we can compare this provision to the fee shifting statutes such as 3801, et cetera, and apply that jurisprudence. And my understanding of your argument was this is not a fee shifting statute. You can't therefore apply these cases. And my question is, I mean, I think that's a pretty fundamental concept. And why would the legislature put in there that you can tax it as costs if it was not intended to be fee-shifting and fall under those line of cases?
Well, I think it's a more fundamental distinction. I don't know why they put it in there as costs. I have no idea. The statute was passed, as you remember, that huge House bill, I think it was House Bill 2, 1991. Many provisions changed in that statute. There's no legislative history on that. It's hard to detect exactly what the reasoning was on that. I do know that the statute was expanded to impose specific duties on insurers in order to get them to do that which they were not doing, and as one of the amicus even attached a commissioner's bulletin which said their computer programs that they're using are not designed to comply with the statute, and he exhorts them to comply. This is as late as 1996. So the statute is designed to encourage litigation to affect a statutory purpose, i.e. comply with the statute. And you do that by assessing penalties because it's hard to determine exactly what damages would flow from the failure to acknowledge a claim, trying to pinpoint what kind of damages resulted from that conduct would be quite difficult. And also to provide for fees to encourage the litigation to go forward. Why they put it as cost, I really do not know. Now, this distinction, I think, is 38001 says valid claim. And obviously, in that statute, the only thing we're talking about is payment. The only thing that 38001 is talking about, like 3.62, in a sense, only we're talking about payment. Here, there are a lot of other statutory duties, and obviously apply to claims that are made, being made by insureds. And if you hold that only a claim that is not subject to an offset is subject to qualifies for the recovery of fees, then essentially read out the private action as a way of enforcing the statute, and that's the only mechanism the statute provides. The insurance commissioner has adopted the 2155 deadlines and put them over in the unfair claim settlement practices regulation under 2121-2, and in that way he's able to enforce it. But the mechanism the legislature chose was for private remedies designed to achieve this public purpose.
Let's go back to that remedy for a second. Under Section 6, aren't there two aspects to the remedy? One is the recovery of attorney's fees, and the other is the recovery of 18% per annum of the amount of the claim.
Right.
And here you're seeking the attorney's fees only.
Correct.
And why are you not seeking the 18% of the claim?
I was not in the trial below, so I don't know. I mean, that decision was made by trial counsel below. It may have been because it anticipated a legal issue about how you're supposed to assess that, calculate that. I mean, it's an interesting question.
What's your argument on the way the statute should be applied as to whether, in dealing with the facts of this particular case, the plaintiff in this lawsuit should be entitled to recover 18% of the claim?
And I believe that in this case, the jury findings of $1,000 actual damages that but for the offset provision would be covered by the policy establish the figure against which the 18% could be applied.
So you think that the 18, I couldn't understand exactly what you said. Did you say that 18% should be applied to the $1,000?
Yes.
Okay, and so do not apply the offset?
No, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking me how, in a situation in which there was no offset,
considering the facts of this case,
I would say 18% ought to apply to the 1,000. This is no different than, it may be different, but it's quite similar to the court's opinion in Stewart Title versus Sterling. In that case, you remember no offsets before trebling.
Just so I'm clear about your position in this case, you think the 18% should be applied to the 1,000 and you do not include the offset?
Absolutely, because it achieves the deterrent effect of the statute. If you recall, in the Sterling versus Stewart Title case, the issue was, do we apply offsets to the actual damages before the damages are trebled pursuant to 2121? The court holds you only apply the offsets after the trebling, because do otherwise would defeat the deterrent effect of the statute.
What are we trying to deter?
You're trying to deter, flip it around, make it a positive, so you're trying to encourage compliance with the statute.
You said the deterrent effect. They didn't owe the 1,000, so what are we trying to deter?
Well, the statute requires them to respond to claims, notices of claims, within 15 days. They did not do it. They admitted they did not do it. The statute requires that it be done. The insurer shall acknowledge the claim within 15 days. That statutory duty is not deterred. Its compliance is not encouraged by a construction of the statute that would limit the attorney's fees and penalty provisions to only those claims for which there is no offset.
But let me be clear about this. You're saying that in this case, even though the claim wasn't made, that you believe that if the law were properly applied to the facts of this case, the 18% should be tacked on to the $1,000.
The 18% of $1,000 would be the penalty amount, correct?
Why would it be $1,000 instead of the claim that she made? She claimed more than $1,000.
Because under the policy of insurance, the claim is for damages. It's essentially a third-party claim in the context of a suit against your insurance company. You're not obliged to pay anything but the actual damages.
So you're not reading Section 6.
Pardon me?
Section 6 could be read easily to say that it's the amount that the claimant says she is claiming.
Correct.
And what was claimed by Ms. Bonner here was more than $1,000.
That's correct.
So why shouldn't the 18% be applied to what she was claiming, which, if I recall, was roughly $1,800?
Well, because the policy only provides for the recovery of actual damages. We have a way of finding out what those actual damages are, and the jury, in this case, found them to be
$1,000. Why you would apply the policy language in that situation, but not apply the policy language with regard to the non-duplication of benefits?
I am applying the policy language with regard to the non-duplication of benefits. It is only by this is no different than the McKinley versus Drozen situation, where you have an offset available because of another provision, in that case another cause of action, in this case another provision of the policy, that allows an offset. The insurance company did not acknowledge the claim. I think all would agree that as to acknowledgement of claims, the word claim has to mean valid or invalid, because you can't know whether valid or not at the time of acknowledgement, and all you're asking the insurance company to do is acknowledge the claim.
But
so,
may I ask you a question? Did I understand you say earlier that this is a contract case because it's based on the policy between Ms. Bonner and Allstate?
It's a cause of action based upon 2155, but obviously...
But what gives Ms. Bonner the right to sue Allstate in the first place?
Well, she has two bases for her action. She has
Without the policy of insurance and her being the insured, she has no claim against Allstate for anything.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
So is it a fair statement? We have to judge the rights of the parties and who's liable for what based on the policy in its entirety.
Absolutely.
Do you agree to that?
Absolutely.
So that it is a contract case, even though she's suing for a penalty provided by a statutory scheme.
Well, I could disagree with that. I mean, I certainly can't disagree.
So then my next question is, if that's the case, don't we use the entire policy to determine the second part of Section 6 for which the insurer is liable, therefore?
You do so at the risk of undercutting the purposes of the statute.
Well, that may be so, but we have to apply what the legislature says is the right to successively maintain a claim under Section 6. You have to show to get the penalty and to get the fees and to get the cost that your carrier is liable, therefore, and if you have to look to the policy, it seems to me you should look to the entire policy.
Well, I want to say, Your Honor, that this is the same colloquy I was having with Justice Abbott, is that they are liable for it. This was not a claim for $1 million on a policy that was never issued. They are liable for uninsured motorist coverage. The only thing that saves them is a non-duplication or an offset provision.
Let me ask you, do you base the liability on the judgment the trial court may render, or do we judge the company's liability on the contract between the parties?
You judge it based upon the verdict rendered by the jury in light of the contractual language. I mean, in this case, the uninsured motorist part of it was stipulated. The negligence, interestingly, was not, but was found by the jury. And damages covered by the policy under the uninsured motorist coverage was found.
But because of the nature of the contract, the damages paid are not to a third party, they're paid to the insured's policy.
That's correct. And that's
but
why,
if you
and
take
that's
the
why
whole policy and apply all of the provisions, Allstate pays nothing to Ms. Bonner. Is that correct?
Absolutely right. Under the contract, because of the offset provision, there is zero recovery. The point is that when you talk about reading all of the contract, you got to read all of the statute. And I think it's interesting may I complete an answer?
You may answer any question.
Thank you.
Without filibuster.
I'm not. Judge knows me well. I just would direct the court's attention briefly to Section 3G. This is the only place in which the statute talks about an invalid claim. If it is determined as a result of arbitration or litigation that a claim received by an insurer is invalid and therefore should not be paid by the insurer, the requirements of subsection F of this section shall not apply in such case. Subsection F only excuse only requires the payment. In other words, the only place where this statute talks about an invalid claim, the only duty it excuses the insurer from complying with is the duty to pay. It does not excuse the other provisions of the chapter.
Thank you. Any other questions? Does anyone have questions?
I have one question.
All right.
We'll
hear from co-counsel.
Can you very quickly tell us, the statute required if the insurer rejected the claim, and I presume there was a rejection of the claim, that it give its reasons for rejection. What reasons did the insurer give for rejecting the claim? Do you recall?
In this case, Your Honor, it was simply a matter of not being able to agree on the settlement amount. The claim was not rejected.
The statute requires if they're not going to pay it within a certain period of time that they have to notify the insurer that they're rejecting the claim, and they have to give the reasons for the rejection. And so my question was, what reasons did they give for the rejection of the claim?
They didn't give any, Your Honor. They simply failed to respond to the claim. The notice was sent to them. Some period of time went by, approximately 30 some odd days, and then we contacted the insurer to say, what gives? Are you going to respond to that? And at that point, they began the process of responding. That's the way they...
Well, I understand, but the first step is notice of the claim. The second step is acceptance or rejection. So after you were in contact with them when they did not acknowledge the claim, did they formally reject the claim at some point in time under the statute? And if so, did they give the reasons for the rejection, and what were those?
They did not, Your Honor. They did not formally reject the claim, and therefore they gave no reasons because they didn't reject it, and in fact they accepted the claim after some period of time.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I want to first return to a couple of Justice Hankinson's questions. The last one regarding whether we rejected the claim. Interestingly, I thought we didn't have a record of this, but if you look at the request for admissions that they sent us, which are in the record at pages 12 and 16 of the clerk's record, they sent us a request for admission that says, admit that the settlement offer you made for UM benefits, not the PIP benefits that we had already paid, admit that that settlement offer of $1,802 did not include, and then it listed certain elements of damages. So in fact, we actually did make a settlement offer in this case of an additional $1,800 that was obviously not accepted. I want to go back to your question about whether this is a covered loss under the policy and make this particular analogy. Let's take, for instance, a general liability policy that has an insuring agreement that broadly covers bodily injury arising from an occurrence. Let's say the claim is within the policy period and all of that. So the claim would fall within the broad insuring agreement. But then let's say it's for pollution, for damages that were caused by pollution. So it's excluded from coverage by the policy's pollution exclusion. Well, that is in no sense a claim that's covered under the policy.
Yeah, but an exclusion means it's expressly not covered by the policy.
Right.
That as I read Kidd says, yes, you can have a covered claim for uninsured motorist benefits under the policy. But before you can actually get the benefits under the policy, you have to account for benefits paid under the PIP provision. And since PIP provisions work up front when there's an accident or an injury so that people can get their money quickly, people tend to get the PIP benefits before the uninsured motorist claim would be resolved. And the question was, how do you reconcile those two coverages in the policy vis-a-vis payment of benefits? Which is a little bit different than an exclusion, which means there's no coverage.
Well, I think it is analogous. It doesn't say there's no coverage. There's no obligation to pay those benefits.
Let me direct. Would you respond to Mr. Maxwell's comments about how if we were to adopt your interpretation of the statute that we would undercut the legislature's intent to encourage insurers to respond promptly and in specific ways to claims that are made, because we will now allow for a covered claim that ultimately was not paid under the policy to escape those provisions?
Well, that particular conduct can be remedied under other statutory provisions in the insurance code, just not this one. For instance, Article 21.21-2 gives the Department of Insurance administrative enforcement power over insurers who fail to promptly or with reasonable promptness acknowledge communications from the insured. There could also potentially be a cause of action under Article 21.21, Section 10. I believe it's subpart 5 or something like that. And this court has even left open the door that in particular situations, if the conduct was egregious enough, you could even have liability for bad faith, and even in the absence of liability under the contract. The court hasn't elaborated on that. So this is conduct that is regulated by other provisions of the insurance code.
Well, but we have to interpret this statute, and we're required to make certain that we adhere to legislative intent. And if the intent of this particular statute is to give a private cause of action as an enforcement mechanism for certain claims handling conduct by insurers, will we be defeating legislative intent, as Mr. Maxwell says, if we adopt your interpretation of the statute? And if not, why not?
The legislature has stated its intent expressly. It's stated that the purpose is to encourage prompt payment of claims, as distinguished from prompt acknowledgement of claims or prompt payment or acknowledgement of demands that are made by the insurer that don't necessarily need to be paid. And so the intent is to encourage prompt payment, and it's certainly not to make you promptly respond to claims that did not need to be paid, but that would be enforceable under other provisions.
Is it your position that under this statute and under various other statutes in light of KID, which means that the non-duplication of benefits provision means that a lot of uninsured motorist benefits are not going to be paid, instead you'll get PIP coverage instead, that particular case is going to affect the various remedies that are in the insurance code in other contexts with respect to prompt handling of claims, because ultimately insurers may not have to pay them because of the non-duplication of benefits provision?
Can you give me an example of which particular?
Well, no, I'm just, you went through all these different remedies that you say exist, right. And yet you're will we be defeating legislative intent, as Mr. Maxwell says, if we adopt your interpretation of the statute? And if not, why not?
The legislature has stated its intent expressly. It's stated that the purpose is to encourage prompt payment of claims, as distinguished from prompt acknowledgement of claims or prompt payment or acknowledgement of demands that are made by the insurer that don't necessarily need to be paid. And so the intent is to encourage prompt payment, and it's certainly not to make you promptly respond to claims that did not need to be paid, but that would be enforceable under other provisions.
Is it your position that under this statute and under various other statutes in light of KID, which means that the non-duplication of benefits provision means that a lot of uninsured motorist benefits are not going to be paid, instead you'll get PIP coverage instead, that particular case is going to affect the various remedies that are in the insurance code in other contexts with respect to prompt handling of claims, because ultimately insurers may not have to pay them because of the non-duplication of benefits provision?
Can you give me an example of which particular?
Well, no, I'm just, you went through all these different remedies that you say exist. And yet your fundamental position is there's no liability under the policy, and therefore their conduct is excused with respect to handling the claim. And my question is, if we adopt that particular interpretation of in how KID affects the handling of claims, are we going to affect the remedial scheme that's in place by the legislature in other contexts, because insurers will be able to say, hey, non-duplication of benefits, don't have to pay, therefore it's not a good claim, and therefore we don't have to worry about our conduct?
Under the provision I first mentioned, Article 21.21-2, where the TDI has private or has administrative power, it references, it just says that insurers engage in unfair claim settlement practices if they do not acknowledge with reasonable promptness claims that are made by insured. I mean, written communications from the insured. not, and it doesn't say written communications that are valid or not valid. So I don't believe that would be the case. And then again, on the bad faith example I gave in the Republic Insurance versus Stoker case, this court said, we're not going to say when, but in egregious enough situations, you can have bad faith, even in the absence of coverage under the contract.
Well, under your statement, then, would under the unfair settlement practices of Part 2, the failure to acknowledge the claim within the 15-day statutory period would be an unfair settlement practice.
But it uses,
is that right?
It uses different language. It says with reasonable promptness. So
well, but the reasonable promptness has been decided by the legislature because they said you have to respond to the notice of the claim within 15 days. Whether you agree whether it's reasonable or not, that's what they said.
So
would you agree then that she could sue separate and apart for that just one failure of Allstate under that section?
I think it's probably fair reading the statute that you would, or at least a good argument could be made, you would carry over the 15 days into that Article 2121-2. You don't have a private right of action under that, under this court's holdings, but it is something where the TDI can come in and...
So in other words, the one person who suffers for the failure to give a timely notice doesn't have an action under the part of the statute that says that's bad practice.
Well, let's look in this case. There was no independent proof that there was any harm suffered at all. And when you look at the harm that suffered...
Well, but the legislature thinks if you don't give prompt notice, there may be a penalty involved. I know your position is it's only triggered if you can find that the carrier is liable therefore, but that's the way they set up the scheme.
So
does your view then write out the opportunity for recovery of the person actually involved?
Now, because again, I do believe there are other provisions in the insurance code, the Article 2121, Section 4, Part, Subpart 10, outlines, requires you to accept or reject claims within a reasonable amount of time. That could be potentially applicable, and then the bad faith example I gave as well. But just, it's not regulated under this particular provision of Article 2155.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
All right.